would like to do is share our experience that we have developed over the last 10 years. And the studies that I will share with you have been sponsored through an R01 through NIH. Sustaining is the difficult part of this title, developing and sustaining community and school-based immunization. Sustaining is hard. This is busy, but this is just to kind of give you a taste of our experience. This is a Texas experience with mass vaccination of children. And our goal has not been just to vaccinate children. Our true goal has been to control seasonal influenza through vaccination of children. And the first 4 years that we did this study, from 98 through 2001, we achieved about a 15% vaccination coverage of children 18 months through 18 years of age. And with that, we were able to demonstrate that we could reduce from 8 to 18% on any given year medically attended acute respiratory illness during the influenza season in adults 35 years of age and older. When we improved vaccination coverage to 30%, and now it was 30% coverage of children 5 to 18 years of age, we noticed that the herd effect or herd protection was actually broadened to more age groups, including the younger child. And in recent years, in 2004 through 2006, we sustained a 30% vaccination coverage of children. And during that time period, we were able to avert anywhere from 4 to 18% of medically attended influenza-related illnesses, depending on the age-specific groups. More importantly, in 2005-06, we believe that our vaccination coverage was able to avert the second wave of the influenza, and that was influenza type B. That this type of data I will not show unless one wants to look at it after, at least during the answering questions. So I don't need to tell you where Texas is, but our field trial is in Central Texas, and we have Temple and Belton, which is our intervention cities. And that's where we actively vaccinate children. And we have Waco, Bryan, and College Station as our comparison cities. And there we do not put effort in vaccinating children. However, throughout Central Texas, we have a surveillance network looking at influenza activity. And we also have a major database from a major healthcare provider for both the intervention and comparison cities so that one can measure the outcome through our program. As stated, our major goal has been to control seasonal influenza through active immunization of school-aged children with the live attenuated and the inactivated influenza vaccines, really depending on the child's health status. We also want to determine the proportion of children who should be vaccinated to reduce the incidence of medically attended acute respiratory illness among all age groups during the influenza epidemic. And MARI happens to be what I would say our surrogate marker for influenza-related illnesses. Our study is a community-based, non-randomized, open-label trial in children. We actively intervene in the intervention cities, as mentioned, Temple, Belton, and surrounding towns. And in the comparison cities, we do not provide vaccines through our program. That does not mean that physicians and the community does not vaccinate them. They do. Over the last 10 years, when we initiated the study in 97, 98, that was what we call a baseline year. We wanted to establish what the age-specific incident rates were for MARI, medically attended acute respiratory illness, in both the intervention and comparison cities, and they were very equivalent. In the next 4 years, from 1998 through 2002, our age group was 18 months through 19 years. And the major vaccine that we used at that time was the investigational live attenuated influenza vaccine. It had not yet been licensed. But those that could not receive that vaccine were given the inactivated influenza vaccine if they fell into an at-risk group. We then had another baseline year, 2002, 2003, and from 2003 through 2006, we initiated our community-based vaccination program, where we actively vaccinated, again, children 5 through 19 years. We had another baseline year, and this past year we've done a school-based approach, which is what most of the talk is going to be, sharing what we have done. Imagine when you go into a community and you're going to start with an investigational vaccine. We chose the live vaccine because we thought it was going to be easier to administer and more acceptable. Well, the way to do that is we really have to educate the community about the importance of influenza. And that's what we did. We took major efforts in educating on the importance of influenza and decided to put our major emphasis on the clinic, administer vaccines through the clinic. As we got more experience, we decided to go out. So we developed a clinic in the mall where we provided influenza vaccines, and we had very successful outreach program where we actually went to the churches in the local areas, we went to the schools, we went to Walmart, we went to the stores, whoever would accept us. And I'll show you the van that we took where we would put up shop there and vaccinate children. In the last year, what we noticed was that going out to the schools where the kids are was the most effective way to vaccinate them. We thereby decided to put our emphasis on school clinics, believing that that would be the most efficient method in reaching out to all kids in the school. I took this picture, and sorry for the flashlight there, but this is a mall, and this is one of the clinics, or a clinic that we operated in the mall during the fall season to go out into the community to vaccinate kids. This is our van that we took almost everywhere, spent a lot of times in it. If it rained, we would vaccinate inside the van. If it was sunny, we would go outside. Let me kind of show you what we were able to achieve in the last 10 years. This is the vaccination coverage in the Scott and White Clinic, which we use as a surrogate marker to indicate how well we're doing. And this is the comparison communities in Waco, Bryan, and College Station. And as one would expect, the elderly adult, 65 years of age and older, is where we're going to have evidence of the best vaccination coverage. And then in adults 50 to 64 years of age, and note that in kids, we are not doing very well during these years. What I would like to note here is in 2004, when there was a major vaccine shortage, note what happened to the vaccination coverage for all ages. Note also that we did not return to what we had achieved previously in 2003 in the comparison communities. And to me, this is something that is very important, and that is vaccine shortage, distribution issues play a major impact on how well we're able to cover all age-specific groups. And this is just an example. This is a little bit more difficult to interpret, but this is now the intervention cities. Temple, Belton, and surrounding towns. And in the initial years when the major vaccine that we were using was investigational, from 1998 through 2001, the elderly adults had the highest vaccination coverage. But we were achieving reasonable vaccination coverage in children 5 to 11 of about 40%. Note what happened in 2003, 04, 05. We were now achieving vaccination coverage of about 60% in children 5 to 11 years of age, while in fact we had surpassed what was being achieved by the community for adults. And here, what I would like to point out with the issue of sustainability, in those years that we did not provide vaccine, and we were providing vaccine free of charge to the children, so in year 2002 and 2006, we did not provide vaccines to them through our program. Note what happened to the influenza vaccination coverage rates for children. It went down precipitously. Again, stating that I think this year, with the issue of the recommendations, we should be able to at least help sustain better vaccination coverage than what we were able to do in this community. This is an overview of the vaccine types that we have delivered during these 7-8 years. In general, about 80-85% of children are recommended because of their health status to receive the live vaccine. About 15% receive the inactivated vaccine because of their health status. When we think about how to best deliver this, I think there's a variety of different models that one can consider. And what we decided when we wanted to expand even better into reach all children, we decided to go into a school-based model. And we used the private and public health care providers to help us in this endeavor. We formed a coalition in the Temple Belton area with the independent school districts. There are 7 independent school districts, with the Bell County Health Department, with the major health care provider, Scott and White, with the University of Mary Hardin and Baylor School of Nursing. In fact, we utilize their nursing students to help with this program and with my institution, Baylor College of Medicine. The ingredients for this school-based influenza vaccination program, I think, to make it successful was community awareness on the burden of influenza. Over the many years that we have been there, this is something that we have always stated and had news release, radios, and so forth to educate them on the impact that influenza has on children and adults every flu season. We also had to win the trust and acceptance by schools and parents of being able to go to the schools to do a school-based program. The support by the public and private health care providers. Our program, we offer influenza vaccines, both alive and inactivated, to all persons in the schools, which means the children and the staff. We had to significantly streamline the consent assent process, and we utilized the system employed by the school. And that is, we provided a packet, an educational packet with a consent form to the teachers who distributed it to the students who took it home to the parents. The parents read it, brought it back to through the children to the schools, and then we vaccinated in those particular schools. But it was very well orchestrated. And we also had to monitor. Like all, I think, successful programs, you need to be able to demonstrate the impact that you're having. And so we're not only looking at community impact, but we're also looking at school impact. This was our mission statement that we provided to the community and to the parents. Annual school-based influenza vaccination of school children will improve the health and wellness in schools, maximize school attendance, and reduce the burden of influenza in our community. Curtailing influenza will also improve student learning, increase the allocation of funds from state and federal resources, and decrease household employment absenteeism. So we had a brochure that we provided to the community, to all the parents, to all the students, also educating them on our program. These are the kids who were lining up to get vaccinated, and note that they have the consent form in their hands, and they have a label. Each of them have a label with their name so that we can readily identify them. This is more happy kids. This is us. We're start, unfortunately, the kids are missing. They're there, believe it or not. They're just missing from this shot, I mean from this picture here. But on the outskirts of the picture, you'll see children getting vaccinated. And here's one little one. They sit beautifully. They're very easy to administer the vaccines. They accept it readily. Here's a little one getting a shot. Not as happy. So what did we do? In the elementary schools, we focused this year on elementary schools simply because we started late in the game. We started our vaccination campaign almost at the end of October, and we finished within the first week of December. We vaccinated in 25 elementary and 3 parochial schools. Each school, we had a half-day clinic. We vaccinated over 5,000 students. About 85% received the live vaccine and about 15% the inactivated. That accounted us vaccinating about 45% vaccination coverage in elementary school children. We vaccinated close to 900 school staff and 900 or close to 1,000 other children through our outreach programs. This is a little busy, and I will just say that remember that we have an influenza surveillance program, and so individuals of all ages come into the clinic and are cultured if they have a febrile respiratory illness for flu. And we focus, our program was vaccinating children 5 to really 11 years of age. That's the elementary grade age. And one can note that in the intervention cities, there were few children who were vaccinated that were cultured, and of those that were cultured, few were positive compared to those that were not vaccinated. On the other hand, in the comparison cities, you can see that there's very comparable proportion to those that are vaccinated to those that are not. And this may indicate that we may be seeing some effect or some herd effect, but time will tell once we analyze our outcome. And so to conclude, we believe the school-based influenza vaccination program was well accepted by the community and offers an option for rapid and efficient vaccination of school children and staff. Thank you very much.
Okay, the floor is open for questions to the three speakers. And while folks are lining up the microphone, I'm going to read a quick housekeeping announcement. You're all invited to the 12th Gerald Lynn Hilleman Lecture and Reception this evening. The lecture will begin at 6 in the Grand Ballroom. It's entitled The Global Control of Infectious Disease Mortality, Contributions of Native American Populations, and will be presented by Dr. Mathieu Centersham. A modest reception, that's the word that was used. Sponsored by the CDC Foundation, will immediately follow the lecture. For those who want to get up early, there is a cardio-funk fitness event at 7 a.m. in the Fulton Cobb Clayton Room. Arrive early, 15 minutes early, so you can sign before the class begins. Tomorrow morning is a special plenary called One World Immunization and Global Health, and that's listed on page 18 of your agenda book. Don't forget about your continuing education credits. And also, there will be a light breakfast tomorrow in the Grand Ballroom beginning at about 8. And so why don't we take the first question, I think, over here.
I'm interested in documentation of the influenza immunizations. I think historically, at least in North Carolina, we've had, a little bit of a problem getting vaccines that were given in these large clinics actually documented in the registry. So, did you use immunization registry, either any of you? And if not, was there a method by which you assured that those vaccine records reached the medical home?
For these studies that I just mentioned, the VNA, no, they did not. And for the three local public health, I believe that they did in that case. And then we also did a study, or not a study, but we did a pilot this fall with the MVNA when they did a flu clinic at the Mall of America where they also used the registry. But it's, I wouldn't say that it's universal or widespread with every single mass clinic that's done in the state, but in a couple situations they did use it.
In our study, we're actually still, this past year, we're still entering data. Keep in mind that we have what I would say limited employees to conduct this. And so our major emphasis when we were vaccinating was to vaccinate. And that was a major task when you think that you're going from one school to another every day and you have to have everything coordinated and ready to go. We're entering data at this time through the Scott and White system. However, it is not going into a state registry yet at this time. It is going, most of the healthcare providers, because Scott and White is the major healthcare provider, will have at least access to the vaccination that we have because it will be entered there, which is a little bit different from a state registry.
Okay, front mic on the right side, please.
Hi, Linda Boyer-Chu from San Francisco. Thank you for your wonderful presentations. I have some questions and I was wondering, you can just decide who'd like to answer them. My first one has to do with the fact that more and more parents do have access to emails and to the internet and have access to an address. And I found this out in San Francisco through a vision program, nothing to do with immunizations, but when parents needed glasses for their children, it was remarkable. Even parents who don't speak English as their first language still had email addresses, so it's quite remarkable. They even had printers, and you know, when I asked them, can you download some forms for consents, they said yes. Maybe they're accessing it at their public library, whatever. When are we going to be able to start using technology and the internet to think about and consent process? That's one question, and you can decide who'd like to respond. I was wondering about the no needle injection system and whether that might be a way to address phobia, because when I've done vaccinations in middle school, I've done them in high schools as well, and in elementary, there is quite a bit of phobia. Once a child gets injected, they look as happy as in those slides, but there is the technology available, and why aren't we looking at that? And I realize it's probably a cost issue. And finally, I love the imagery, Kristen, of the elephant. I like to use the one of starfish and, you know, saving starfish, the starfish that get caught out in the sandbars, but you save them only one at a time. And I think it's really true. I'm afraid of the fact that we're trying to do immunization so quickly. And so maybe one of you can respond to, can we look at the mandates of the flu vaccine? When do you think that's actually going to happen? Is it going to be in 2008 or 2009? I don't think so. But, you know, how soon should we expect that? Because the school systems are not set up. We're facing such huge cuts in our state alone, and I'm sure it's country nationally. So thank you very much.
Well, with the issue of technology, for our study, we actually have a web page that provides real-time information as to where we are with vaccination, what school we're going to be vaccinating at, and so forth. But it does not address your question with a consent process. Since ours is a study that require IRB approval rather than a policy, I think that we're not yet there from a study perspective, but that's something worthwhile to entertain. With regards to the needle phobia, I would like to state, I think I heard it maybe in Christian's earlier discussion, that there are nurses who I do not know how they have it, but they just have a knack. They have a knack with children. And this was demonstrated very well in our study. There's several nurses who devoted their time to vaccinating children. And they would just talk to them. And normally, you know, you think it may take 15 minutes to talk to them to quiet them down. Generally, it just took 2 minutes. And they may not have a smile, you know, a smiling face at the beginning, but then they're relieved that's all over and wasn't as bad as they thought it would be. So I think with having very good nurses in administering inactivated vaccine, that at least can get away from somewhat of the needle phobia. And I think the last one was mandate for school. Yes, that one I can't comment on, but I think one of the difficulties that we will have to face is thinking of influenza as a seasonal vaccine that needs to be administered annually, and thereby makes mandating it much more difficult for school entry. When are we going to have vaccines available? I would hope that as our vaccines improve and technology develops, that we can change the way that we think about influenza as a seasonal flu to a year-round. And what I mean by that is, I think probably in the next 5 years, we will have vaccines that can give you lasting immunity for truly a year or more, that will be able to provide protection not just against the virus that it's in the vaccine, but to be able to provide more robust protection against variants. And if you're able to do that, then I think we will be able to at least jump a major hurdle where we are always trying to crunch, you know, vaccinate children October and November before the flu season. I'm hoping that that will happen.
Sure, I'll comment. I think that your suggested use of technology is excellent. I think it's something that should be taken advantage of when it's available. I do think it's important to consider that not everyone may have that available, and so. But I know that even for my own kids, daily announcements, it's fabulous. And I think it can be used. I guess one of the things that we've talked about in Minnesota is just that we don't want to assume that every district and that every parent has access to that. And then in terms of the mandating and universal vaccination, I think that at least from the perspective of program managers, I think I can say this fairly broadly, as we looked at, for instance, the new vaccine for HPV and things like that, I think that school mandates are very valuable in ensuring that kids get vaccinated, but I think that we really respect what power they hold, I guess, and that we want to be very judicious in how we utilize those things. So I don't think that you would see any rush to having any mandates other than just a recommendation from the ACIP at this point. Because of that, wanting to be very judicious in how we view school mandates. And I appreciate that the ACIP recognizes that there needs to be some time for phasing this in, and that at least for 2 years acknowledges eating an elephant one bite at a time.
I think as someone has already acknowledged, the amount of money at the local level is becoming smaller and smaller. So I think we're probably going to find ourselves in a position of having to advocate for reallocating monies. So I'm really interested in any kind of cost analysis. Several different models were mentioned. Is there any data at this point that shows whether the VNA model versus the public health collaborative model versus the model used in Baylor is more cost effective from the standpoint of how many dollars it took to immunize one school age child? Any data available?
I think as far as the costs go, it's the best probably we can hope for is to have communities at the local level decide what fits best for them. I would be reluctant to think that there would be sort of a national recommendation that school-based vaccination clinics are the most cost-effective or something. There are certainly a number of cost models that I think you'll see in the published literature, and it have come out in the last couple of months, and certainly these mass immunization clinics, especially at schools, look quite good compared to delivering vaccination in the medical home. But I really think that it's going to be a local level. There may be communities where the medical home makes the most sense, even from a cost perspective. Sort of a non-answer for you.
I'll just comment that the example that I gave with the collaborating with the Visiting Nurse Association, there was no upfront cost in that, it's their vaccine, they offered it at a fee, but they provided vaccine at a school location. And so in that regard, in terms of the, public health or the schools incurring a cost, there was none. Obviously that's not gonna be ideal in every setting, but that's an option to consider.
On the right, please.
So that's actually a good lead into the question I had, which was when you did this public-private partnership with VNA, it sounds as if they charge for vaccines. Was any attempt made to offer VFC vaccine offered through VNA?
This was actually their initiative. So I'd like to say that we initiated it with them, but actually it was their idea. And they actually do provide care for homeless and other populations in our community, so that there would be a resource for kids that couldn't afford vaccine, but they set it up as a system where, they would actually be able to receive payment for the vaccine that they offered.
And when you say there's no upfront cost, did the school have to participate in any way? Did they send out consent forms or do anything other than provide information that this clinic would be available?
The school nurse was the cheerleader but wasn't responsible for coordinating things. So they would work with the MVNA to send information out but didn't have to do the photocopying and things like that, which we're hearing, at least in Minnesota, with some other legislation that's currently going through, that even making copies of things to send home to parents is a burden for schools.
I'm not sure who's first. Why don't we try the left?
Hi, my question is about the children under 9 years old. Did you have some sort of reminder recall for the second dose of influenza vaccination? And was there any way did you track them, or if you had any idea of how to find out if that was their initial vaccination or if they needed the two vaccinations? And also if that also was included in your statistics of the 5,000 children, was that also included, that the second dose of vaccination?
We have an auto dial system that remind the parents that these children are under 9 years of age, and that if they have not previously received an influenza vaccine, that they will require two. The reality is that very few of them come back for a second dose. The numbers that I gave you were for single dose. For this particular year, I would state, I don't have the final number, but it'll probably be less than 150 out of over 3,000 children. And again, I don't know yet what percent of those under 9 years will require two doses. Now, one of the advantages of a live vaccine is that you do have duration, you do have efficacy that has been demonstrated with one dose, and that has been shown in multiple studies. It may not be as high as two doses when the kids receive it for the first time, but it's still pretty appreciable. And from a public health perspective, being able to administer a single dose to many, many children becomes, at least in my mind, very important. That's what we have done for the last decade, and it has worked relatively well in starting to improve control of seasonal flu.
On the right, please.
My question goes back to record keeping. I guess it's for both Kristen and for Dr. Piedro. Did the school nurses get a list of all the children who were vaccinated just so that they would have copies of the records? Was number one, because what we do in our county is we have, when we have the parents sign consent forms, we also have them sign HIPAA forms so we can share the information with the school nurses. And my other, the other part to my question is, how did you get the records home to the parents? Did the staff have cards or something to give to the children? And where do you, if the parent was looking for the shot record, where would they find it?
Very good questions. With regards to getting information to the parents, we provided a packet. So it was the study team that did all the thousands and thousands of copying and, you know, made the packets and provided to all the different schools. There were about 28 elementary schools that we provided, oh, I would say, about 500 to 600 packets per school. And the elementary schools, what's nice about it, at least we're in Central Texas, and I'm sure throughout the U.S., kids have to bring back home things for review. And so it becomes a very efficient method of communication between teachers and parents through the child. And so every Tuesday in Central Texas, the parents know that they got to check their students, their sons or daughters' backpack to make sure that, you know, their weekly report is there and what they're going to accomplish for that week. And so we took advantage of that and provided our influenza vaccination packet to them. And then they come back through the students to the teacher. And then the teacher kind of organizes it. And we then go to that school. With regards to do the school nurses, do they know who was vaccinated? Did we provide information as to whom we vaccinated or not? The answer is no, not on the spot. They have a pretty good idea of who was vaccinated just simply because they were involved, but we did not enter data right then and there. We did not have the personnel to be able to enter all those we were vaccinating on a daily basis. We barely had the personnel to go from school to school on a daily basis.
Just one other quick question. Who bought that beautiful van for you?
I'm sorry?
Who bought that beautiful van for you?
Your van.
Oh, the van.
We did.
With
RON? Who drove it?
No, who bought it for you?
No, actually, it's Scott and White. And believe it or not, they use this as a method for instructing computer technology to different people. And so we kind of hijacked their van. Their computers were there. We hijacked it and made it into a vaccination van.
We use our station wagons.
I was just going to say that in terms of record keeping, the school nurses have access to our immunization registry. So they would have access to records that are entered into that. And then because influenza is not part of the school immunization lot, it's not something that they would need to be tracking at the school level. And we have Friday folders in Minnesota.
Gentleman in the back.
Yes, Howard Backer from California. A question in relation to sustainable model. It didn't sound like either of you actually billed for vaccination, but so how do you, if we're talking about expanding to all the schools, who's going to pay for the vaccine if we're not a universal state? Did either of you solve that problem?
Howard, I'll solve that for you. No, not really, but I think that the VNA model was something that was an option that didn't involve, sort of outside funding. Obviously, it is dependent on, the parents' ability to pay at some level, and we could expand that to make sure that VFC-eligible kids could participate. But I think that's one of the things that we saw as a challenge to the three-county project that I showed to you, because that cost $200,000, which isn't huge, I guess, in the scope of things, but that was $200,000 to vaccinate school kids in three counties in Minnesota, and there's no way that we can afford to extrapolate and expand that to the 87 counties that we have, when you think about the cost. So we presented that to show that it can be done, but I think that we need to be looking at alternatives, because we can't expect to get free vaccine from manufacturers. We can't expect to be able to get funding from CDC to be able to do these things. And that's why we appreciated that partnership with the Visiting Nurse Association, because we thought that might be some way that we could, establish something that could be sustainable.
I don't have any better answer. All I can tell you is that since it's been a study, our goal has been to control seasonal flu, not to get paid or reimbursed, but that's going to be a very important issue for sustainability. I would say something that would be equally important, which is what we're trying to demonstrate over the years, is the direct and indirect benefit associated with such a program. And if you can demonstrate that you have really significant indirect benefit to the community, I think it becomes an easier task to try to build stronger coalitions with other providers and businesses who all have a stake in trying to control seasonal influenza.
So my question is actually sort of on the same note. I'm curious about that one slide, and it went up very quickly, where you showed that in the years where you didn't actually conduct the program, those were survey years, baseline years, the rate of vaccination or participation in annual flu vaccination for those communities, the Temple and Belton, where you actually did the intervention, it looked like it went down to zero. Now, that probably was just me not really paying attention to it, but it did drop precipitously. And yet, one would think that if you had been doing it year in, year out, that the community would be accustomed to receiving, or getting their annual vaccinations for their children. I'm wondering whether you can comment on why it dropped so significantly, even though I know there wasn't free vaccine, but it seems like it should not have gone down that much.
I agree, and I think this is a lesson to learn. I mean, when things are free and you break down barriers, and one of the major barriers that we broke was accessibility and cost. And so those are going to be barriers later on for implementation. We always talk about, how do we improve vaccination coverage? What are the barriers that we have to overcome? Well, we did two of the major barriers, accessibility and cost related with the vaccine. You take those away and you see that your program falters. And that's, in essence, despite many years of being there and educating what we believe the community on the importance of vaccinating against flu.
Question on the right.
So how did you measure success? Was it measured by number of doses provided to children over and above previous years, or was it measured by attendance rates? And if you measured it by attendance rate, how did you attribute better attendance to having received the flu shot?
Our true measure of success is when we finally are able to truly control seasonal influenza, like we think about other childhood diseases, where one can, instead of seeing annual influenza outbreaks, where we may just see a little spattering of flu isolates. That's really our true measure of success. And what we have noted is that when we increase vaccination coverage, let's say of children, from 15% to 30%, the indirect or herd protection that we're observing starts to expand not only in adults, but it starts to expand to other age groups, in particular children. And we measure this through a database by the major healthcare providers in the intervention and comparison cities. The major healthcare provider provides care to about 80% of the population in Temple and Belton area, and about 25% of the population in our comparison community. So that's how we measure success. Obviously, once we achieve higher and higher vaccination coverage, we will feel good. This year, we believe that through the school-based system, it was, to me, a work of beauty. To go to a school where clinics have not been held before, to basically have each class come through within like a 15-minute process, class by class, and you're able to vaccinate. The schools there, elementary schools, are about 300 to 600. And you're able to vaccinate about half the participants of that school in about four-hour period. And you do this, you know, day in and day out. To me, I have never seen something so work so nicely. And we didn't have many staff. Normally, we had about anywhere from 5 to 7 people working on this program. And they were the same 5 to 7 people that worked on this program for 2 months vaccinating, or actually it was 6-week period. It's a very efficient method to vaccinate kids.